Accession number 12882, Mr. and Mrs. Howe, Reel 3.
But after that, we had to sort of, you know, we were expecting them any day and that. And then you had to go on for a patrol, Home Guards was their patrol. Mm. And in the end, we used to go take our things up as it getting dark, up into the tunnels, you know, if you do the tunnels at Vickers and that, and go and sleep on these boards and that to stay the night. So that was, you know, that was night after night we used to, and we used to sort of just come out as it got to. To dawn, and that.
Well, the reason was that most of us belonged to the Home Guard, which was called the LDV in the first instance, the Local Defence Volunteers, and it was it was Dad's Army, you know, rather a bit comical, really, but there you are, We were told that because nobody could work at that time because of the conditions of the blackout. Of course, the factory was, you know, and that because of the blackout, nobody could work. See? So we were put on picket, night picket, and of course she would then be left on her own.
So I made sure that
she wouldn't be on her own, that she would go up in and sleep and get into the tunnel, into the air raid shelters in the old sand pit.
St. George's Hills, they sort of tell me. They were very good, though, because you could hear bombs dropped. I mean, just sort of sure they were safe.
They had big air raid shelters
at St.
George's Hills?
Yeah, they made these sand pits just before the war.
Did they?
Mm. Yeah. There was a sand pit there, right opposite the works, right opposite to the offices now, across the road from there.
Where the car park is?
It's a car park. Yeah, it is a big car park.
Opposite the office building.
That's right. Well, up there, there used to be the fire station, used to be there during the war for the works. And a first aid place as well. And then at the back of it were these concrete tunnels built into the back of the sand pit. And there were, I don't know how many there were, 10 or a dozen, I suppose, all interconnected, but they were... It was a gruesome place, really, because it was damp, smelled musty, and not very pleasant at all. But of course, when the bombing was on, it was a good place to be. If you know, when they were dropping large laps around.
Quite a lot dropped after us and around our roads. And
of course, I wasn't keen for me to go to work at night and leave her at home. So we arranged that they. Most of the people took refuge in the shelters at night. And of course, the bombing was pretty horrendous then, in the late 40s.
When the factory was raided, how long was production stopped for?
Well, I should think about a couple of weeks. I would think no more.
Oh, only a short time.
They started again because we were fortunate. They hadn't touched our jigs, our fuselage jigs. The wing shop was worst affected, I think, because that was upstairs, and the bomb came through into just by the side of the machine shop, and the machine shop was they'd done a lot of damage to the machine shop, and the wing shop, and the tin bashers, the tinsmith shop, but we were fortunate. We were out, and the erecting shop, they weren't touched very much, and the fuselages were up at the top end of the erecting shop. And our jigs were safe. They checked them all over, but they hadn't been pushed out of alignment at all, so they were all right. So we continued then with what stock was left to start to build aircraft again. And in the meantime, they shuttled all the other stuff away. A lot of them went to Walton, Hersham, or wherever, you know, Shepperton. They took over some of the even the film studios to build parts.
And was the factory up at Chester working by that time?
Oh yes, that was started before the war.
And that was pushing Wellingtons through,
that
wasn't it?
That was making Wellingtons. And then, of course, they went at Squire's Gate, Blackpool. That was just about starting as well, I would think, by then. I think by about 1940, they must have been doing, you know, must have been going pretty well, I should think. Especially Chester, which was started first. And then, of course, I don't think we ever got back to making 20, whatever it was, a week. Because I don't think, well, it probably wasn't necessary by then for us to do that.
But didn't they make Wellingtons out in Canada as well?
I don't know. I don't ever remember that. And whether they might, I don't
think,
know.
Or was it Lancaster's? I think maybe it was Lancaster's they built out there. It
could have been Lancaster's, I suppose. Mm. Because Wellingtons, by 1941, too, Wellingtons were getting phased out by then because Lancaster's were coming in, you know, they were a good aircraft and... And of course, they were coming on a treat by then, and there was, you know, the Wellingtons were. I think a lot of the Wellington work then was a lot of it was experimental work, you know. Cause they, especially for Coastal Command, for the submarine. The submarines were a great threat, of course, and I think they concentrated a lot of work on Wellingtons then on doing. Anti-submarine work, you know. Well, the Lee Light, of course, was one case in point. And then, of course, there was the other one with the, all sort of aerials all over it for that detection. And various other things they tried out at different times.
Who were the personalities that stick in your mind from those days? I mean, I believe the young George Edwards designed the... degaussing ring, didn't he, on the Wellington?
That's right.
Did you come across them much?
Oh, George Edwards, oh yes. I George Edwards was in charge of the experimental shop. When we were down at Fox Warren, we went to Fox Warren, I went to Fox Warren in 1950 to build the Valiant. We built the Valiant then, we built the prototype Valiants at Fox Warren, all the bits, and it was taken down to Wisley and assembled at Wisley.
And you saw the first flight of the Valiant, did you?
Yeah, yes, from Wisley, yes. Oh, yeah.
Charlie Houghton,
he was the manager in charge of it all. Yes, he was a real driving force, Charles. He was. I mean, work was everything, you know, he was a workaholic, really.
You used to make tools, didn't you? Much cheaper than you could ever, yes, Lisa.
Well, we used to make, that was for the, BC-10 and the Vanguard.
Did you come across Barnes Wallis at all in your work?
Yes, well, I never met the man, not really. But of course, I used to see him around there all the time. You know, he used to come down the works at different times. And, of course, I remember the man before him originally, of course, Rex Pearson. He was the chief designer when I went there first. And the man responsible for all the early aircraft we had, you know. Although it was a Barnes Wallis design, the geodetic. It was Rex Pearson who actually designed the aeroplane, and was in charge of all the design and design staff. And of course, Barnes Wallis was more or less a law unto himself. Really, he had that place above, well, where the museum is now, and he sort of reigned supreme there and did all his designs up there and all these various things. The spinning bomb was, of course.
Did you have to do that?
And we did some work on that. And
did you know many of the pilots in those days, like Mutz?
I remember one or two of them. I didn't know them personally, of course, because they weren't in our part of the part of the works. They were more or less on their own. Yes, I remember Tommy Luck, Shorty, Longbottom, Handyside.
Summers, wasn't
he? Oh, Matt Summers. Yeah. Matt Summers was, well, he was the chief pilot when I went there. Nobody could fly a Wellington like Matt Summers. He was incredible. You could see him come in and he'd fishtail it like that, and the thing would just, he'd grease it down on the grass every time. He's a marvellous pilot, you know. Had a wonderful touch. But he was another character, he was really.
Do you remember any of them?
He used to drive a boat in one of them little 500 Fiats, you know. And he was about tremendously, you know, he wasn't very tall now, but he was a big man. And how he used to fit himself into one of them 500 Fiats, I'll never know. I remember in Guy Gibson's book, or somebody writing about Gibson, he apparently went to Weybridge Station to meet Gibson, apparently, when he was coming to the works. And of course Gibson wasn't exactly a small man either, apparently, and there were two, I can imagine, it must have been quite a sight to see them, two of them, in that little, in a little 500 Fiat, you know. You remember that, you don't know anything about them, you know.
Oh, the Topolino, the mouse.
Yeah, well, yeah. It was a bit like that, you know. And, but, oh. It had this little, you know, like a sewing, but the size of a sewing machine, the engine was.
You, in your days before the war, working on the aircraft side, of course, motor racing was still going on.
Oh,
the track.
Yeah.
I mean, did they get in your way a lot?
Well, no. You see, we weren't allowed across the track when they were having their even on their practice days. If we wanted to cross the track with an airplane, they had to phone up across the track to their headquarters across the track, and a chap would come round with a red flag and drive around. I think it was an old Model T, if I remember rightly, they used to drive around on. And we were allowed to push the aircraft across the bridge and across onto the grass. But I don't know, I think they used to charge because of pound a time, I think, or something like that.
And there you are building aeroplanes for the war effort, presumably, like a prototype Wellington.
Yeah, well, of course, that was finished. There were no racing after 39.
No, but I mean the prototype Wellington flew when? About 38?
Oh, yes. Well, all of them. The Wellesleys and any of those aircraft.
All the power of the time.
Up to 39. And of course they'd have practice days, you see, not only the race days, but the practice days as well. Of course the race days were mostly Saturdays anyway, and there was nobody working in the works after 12 o'clock on Saturdays. But they'd have all days on end when they'd have practice, people practicing around it. And then, of course, there was all the other people with their prototype motor cars. You know, there was like the bloke with the bluebird, you know.
Campbell.
Campbell. Mm. It was Campbell. He was there with, you know, and he'd always be, and people like him, you know, driving around, Freddie Dixon, and different people, you know, and the motorcycle people like what was his name?
Denley?
He lived in Byfield. Denley. He would be, you know, they would all be having their separate goes on the track on different days. And any time there was practicing on the track, of course, our place was the aircraft place was all shut up away from the track, because the track was right outside the hangar door.
So did this cause a lot of interruption in your work then? I mean, there were the days when you couldn't fly, or?
I don't think so, really. I think not that I remember. I think that when they wanted to push an aircraft across, I think they was usually able to do it whenever they wanted, more or less, say within half an hour or whatever. And it didn't take long to push it across the track. You see, once it was across the track and over the bridge, it was out of the way of the racing people.
Anyway. Did they own the airfield as well?
The airfield was used by the Brooklands Flying Club. You know, know, they had all a lot of light aircraft there. They used to fly around, but then again, that was mostly weekend as far as they were concerned. They were Saturday and Sundays mostly that they used it, you know, but to any great extent. Of course, they used to have different people flying in and out at different times, but and they had their own control place, which is, I don't know, I think it's still, it must
well, control
there.
Car.
Yeah, they've kept that, haven't they?
It's still
they've
there,
kept
I believe.
The
and they got the hat, they got the little hat where they sold the first air
sell
tickets.
Sold the tickets, that's fair, that's still
first
there.
First air tickets must be there somewhere,
yes,
still.
Yes, it is, it's still there.
I suppose it's
that.
Somebody's got it.
Because we used to sort of go up and up the, what they call the batter and that, and watch them on the racing over the children get chased down, and that sort of dangerous. I mean, they only had those sort of wooden, aircraft sort of sleepers, and no, the railway sleepers are just at the top, because there were several bad accidents anyway with them going over the top.
Mm.
And that, but it was quite fun though, because I mean, we used to go over there. We used to go, of course, there was a bridge originally over where we father used to take us on
members
race
bridge.
Day and that. Yes,
members two members bridge. One got blown up by the bomb that dropped, the one that dropped up the end of the works. Mm. There was a bridge across the track there, right across to the paddock, and that got blown up because of the bomb dropped down immediately underneath it almost.
The only way we could get over was over a bridge, you know, from Oyster Lane. There was a bridge you used to go right over that, from that.
Yes, it was.
And there was a motorcycling one, but it was you had some of the photographs, didn't you, gave to the museum of the cars and that, and some of the lady drivers and that. And because you sort of knew or saw some of those, didn't you?
Yeah, well, I had some pictures left from 1930-31 of the Snyder Trophy, the S6B. I gave them that, and
you saw it fly down at Carlshot, did you? Now
I didn't see the actual flight. I was down there once with a cousin of mine, and they used to live at Totten, and we used to go down to the end. I can't remember where it was now. My cousin used to take me down there, and we used to see them practicing, you know, going around. And of course, for those days, they used to go on a hell of a lick. You used to see them going around, you know. I mean, we couldn't believe our eyes, because they were tremendously fast for those days. I mean, 400 miles an hour was, I mean, out of this world.
Mm.
When one of the ordinary aircraft were doing well, if they, some of them got up to 200, that was about it, you know.
Mm. Mm.
But it was mostly much slower than that, most of the aircraft. But they were quite a sight to see some of them go around.
Do you often think of, you know, now that you've finished with the aircraft industry, and how your working life has spanned such a huge area of technology? You're talking about the wildebeest at the early part of this interview. And you finished on Concorde. I mean, that's a huge development in one person's life, isn't it?
Well, of course, it all come about because of the jet engine, wasn't it, really? I mean, they would never have got anywhere, not like they have, without the jet engine. The jet engine was the major thing that happened, the development of the jet engine, as absolutely revolutionised aircraft almost overnight, as it were.
But one of the things that I think, when they keep applying for these aircraft works or with knowledge, it's such a shame that there's these people with all this knowledge. I mean, they were just sort of not wanted and that, and yet they've got so much they could have offered to these, you know, to the generations coming up, really. It's just a shame, because, you know, there's so much, I mean...
You mean technical knowledge of
aerodynamic
shapes
and so on? Everything and that. And I often say to me, I wish you'd write a book, because, you know, the details he's told me, I mean, he hasn't said half of them, and it's really interesting. And he said, well, I'm no good at writing. I said, well, all you've got to put down is in, somebody would do it for you. But it really, the things that he's told me are so interesting and so, you know, and clever and everything, you know, and I mean, he was only sort of end up as a fitter assembler, but it seems a shame because it was, theirs was the hard work, really, and that, and, you know, this, and it was, well, pounds worth of things they did, thousands of pounds worth of things they did, and his knowledge, now saying that, but it, you know, be so nice for them to carry on and to help these sort of people, even if they went sort of voluntary in that, I mean, be nice for them, because, I mean, he's still keen on all these things, to give knowledge to these
it's all out of this, out of my scope now. I mean,
of course you've got a lot of the veterans who are working on the aircraft at Brooklands now.
Yes, oh, yeah.
And they help build. I mean, you know, I talked to Ted Petty, who's a VC-10 man, and then there's a whole gang of people working on the Wellington,
because that Wellington that's in there was in Loch Ness. My husband actually worked on that.
That was a Weybridge aircraft, apparently, so they tell us. Yeah, so if it was a Weybridge aircraft, it was obviously one I'd worked on at some time or other.
He was so surprised being able to see sort of the bits and that. He said, oh, that goes so and so and so and so. And this Mr.
Woodall. Was it Woodall you were talking about?
Yes.
No, not what was his name?
The gentleman that asked us down there to the museum to come and see Goodall.
Oh, my Goodall.
Mr. Goodall, that's right, yes.
Goodall.
I mean, he took us round there.
No, get his name.
No, Mr. Goodall, he took us all round there, and of course, he was able to, and he said, oh, you know, and they got bits from that missing. He said, well, how does that sound so went there? He said, oh, I'd love you. He said, can I, you know, ask you at any time if you. Ring you up and say, you know, come down and sort of.
Well, if it was nearer.
I said, yes.
Yeah. If it was nearer, I wouldn't mind, you know, going over there, but I'm to help out, but it's too far away for me now.
No, you see, I think a lot of the people who live over there now, it's a bit like a club in a way.
Yeah, keep in touch.
And, you know, there are a lot of veterans from Vickers who give so much time.
Oh, yes.
To working in the hangars or mowing the grass or.
Well, that's what amazed us with the Jack Bright. I mean, there he's in the sort of gardening, clearing up. I thought, it must mean an awful lot to him. I mean, I suppose it's just a pleasure being there amongst
I think it's something you'll never find again.
I think
the feeling that there was at Vickers. I talked to so many people like yourself over and over again, and you'd never find it again in a modern factory.
No, because
that's the. Well, I think one of the best gangs I ever worked for was the one at Fox Warren, because there were people there who were absolute experts, you know, they really were. They were really great. And there wasn't anything they couldn't make. Some of those tinsmiths down there were real wizards. Real wizards they were. And we turned out the valiant there, and you know, with comparatively few people really.
Mm.
You know, when you think of, you know, I mean, there was only a couple of old, I mean, hangars. They leaked like the devil. Every time it rained, the floors got flooded, and it froze you in winter.
How many valiants did you build altogether?
I think we built five there, because the first one boarded, didn't it? They crashed the first one, or it went, something happened.
But on the production, I mean, the RAF bought many more than five.
Oh, yes, but they were all built at the main works, see?
Where was that?
W1.
On the Brooklyn side.
In the main works, but we were down at Fox Warren.
Mm.
Did you know where Fox Warren was? Rennie Road. On the, you know,
Come off the A3 on, and
where
you're
going to the
A3, through,
that's
yes.
right, yeah. Yeah, well, we had those two old hangars there, the bit they were put up during the war. No, there was one down the bottom as well. But we used the ones up the top end, really. And they were put there during the war for experimental purposes. I suppose they built most of the Windsor there for a start. The Windsor, which then another aircraft, it didn't come to anything eventually, because the war came to an end. But I think that was, you know, quite a good aircraft.
It did fly, didn't it?
Oh, yes. Mm. Oh, yes, it flew quite a bit, yes. Oh yeah, I think it had quite a lot of, you know, different features about it that were quite new for those days, I think. It had the guns on facing out to the back and hydraulically operated from remote control. And
four main wheels, I believe, one under each engine, wasn't it?
Yeah. Oh, it was quite a, you know, I think it was quite a thing for those days.